2950 or go to givetowbai.org online. Your donations, regardless of amount, will be greatly appreciated. Now stay tuned for Black Agenda Radio. Coming up, it's 5 p.m.
Agenda Radio, where we provide news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Coming up, the Cuban Revolution survives despite a 60-year-long blockade. And the late Glenn Ford explained the importance of saying the names of political prisoners while they still live. But first, we will hear about the long history of Black and Palestinian solidarity. First, we speak to Asantewaa Nkrumah Touré. She is an organizer and dues-paying member of Black Alliance for Peace, Philadelphia. She recently spoke at the Al Auda Conference in New York to discuss the history of Black and Palestinian solidarity. She joins us from Philadelphia to discuss her conference reflections.
I had the great pleasure of representing Black Alliance for Peace at the 14th annual Al Auda Conference in New York City.
And what's the most important thing that we need to know about the history of Black solidarity with Palestine?
The task we were given in terms of our participation on this panel was to tie in our anti-imperialist work, or how our anti-imperialist work ties in to overall Palestine solidarity. And what I explained in my presentation is that for many of our members of Black Alliance for Peace, we are longtime organizers, we are longtime members of the movement. Many of our members have traveled to Palestine, have met Palestinian people, have done all types of solidarity work with Palestine for many, many years. I gave an overview of some of that history. So, for example, I talked about how the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, he wrote a statement basically criticizing the creation of the State of Israel and the old Muhammad Speaks Nation of Islam newspaper. This was in the late 1940s, early 1950s. I talked about Malcolm X's essay, Zionist Logic, written September 17th, 1964, written while he was in Egypt at the invitation of Gamal Nasser. I talked about Shirley Graham Du Bois, who wrote a piece called There Can Never Be Peace with Zionism. She also wrote that late 1967, 1968, while she too was in Egypt at the invitation of Nasser. We have other examples. We have Black Lives Matter Dream Defenders who visited Palestine in 2015, 2016. We have the All African People's Revolutionary Party and our longtime work with Palestine Solidarity and a project we had in the 1990s called the African Anti-Zionist Front. So these are just a few examples, and it'd be remiss if I didn't mention how my big brother Kwame Ture, when he was in SNCC, he was part of the group of SNCC members who came out in solidarity with the Palestinian people, and also came out against Zionism. That was very significant. There was a sister in SNCC at that time, Ethel Miner, who, by the way, is still alive. She met Palestinians when she was traveling in South America. When she came back to the United States, she wrote a series of articles about Palestine, about Zionism, and why this was an important issue, et cetera. Those articles that she wrote appeared in the SNCC newsletter. And as you know, Margaret, that was controversial at that time, and it's controversial even now, still today. So these and other examples are very important to just show people that this solidarity with Palestine has a long, rich history, and it's a history that we all can be proud of.
What There's so many things that people need to know about the history of Palestine, but if you had to mention one thing, the most important thing that you think people need to know now, what would that be?
Well, it's kind of hard to narrow it down to one thing, but I can say as a Christian who has read some of the Bible, there is no theological or political justification for Zionism at all. At all. All religions, we're talking about Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. We are the children of Abraham. All these religions uphold principles of justice, and there's nothing at all in Zionism that upholds principles of justice when we look at the bloody and vicious history of Zionism before and after 1948, when Israel was created. We look at the deliberate confusion that the Zionists spread, confusing religion and race and national origin, etc. But the most horrendous thing is the confusion of Zionism as a political ideology with religion. But in all of that, we have to be careful. We cannot let any religion be misused to justify any type of injustice. So for these reasons and many more, we have to be careful, and we have to study these things very seriously.
And the designation of Israel as an apartheid state. Recently, Amnesty International joined many other organizations and individuals in documenting their conclusion that Israel is an apartheid state. And this Amnesty International being the organization that it is, imperialism in matters of foreign policy, there was a lot of condemnation, and some of the media, such as the New York Times, chose just to ignore it and try to disappear it. What do you conclude about that, that an organization that ordinarily is supportive of U.S. foreign policy publicly stating for the record that Israel is an apartheid state?
Well, we can salute Amnesty International and other human rights organizations for finally calling Israel an apartheid state. We salute them. But if we know our history, we also have to ask the question, what took them so long? I can tell you from my personal experience of being active in the Free South Africa movement, we were making connections about apartheid in South Africa and what Amnesty International now calls apartheid in Israel. We were saying that in the late 1970s, 1980s, during the Free South Africa movement. I was in Washington, D.C. at the time. We were organizing the demonstration at the South African Embassy, and some of us from the All African People's Revolutionary Party and other organizations, we had signs that said South Africa is an apartheid state. We had signs that says Israel is an apartheid state. And some of the liberal Zionists who were part of that mix would be upset. They would want to argue, etc. We stood firm. So we congratulate Amnesty International for finally coming to this place. Again, what took them so long? But we know it's a result of struggle, ideological struggle from the social justice movements, and of course, struggle of the heroic Palestinian people, and always their courageous and steadfast resistance to any type of aggression or violence coming from the Zionists. So those two things play major roles in finally coming to that point. And I must also say too, Mark, we have to salute our comrades from Jewish Voices for Peace, who just in the last 3, 4, 5 years came out and made a public statement stating that as Jewish people, they condemn Zionism, they condemn it, and they seek to, you know, condemn it in the strongest words and the strongest forms. That's a very significant thing, because we know for many of our anti-imperialist Jewish comrades, for some of them, that was a long, hard struggle as well, to come to the point where, as a Jewish person, you condemn Zionism. And we know that some of them had strong reactions from family and friends, families that, you know, had very difficult relations after they came to that conclusion. But it was the right conclusion. It was the right thing to do. And as I always say, we have to oppose Zionism both theologically and politically.
We know that, like many lobbies, there are lobbies for everything in this country, from every institution, every group who want to influence the political system. And Zionism is no different in lobbying elected officials. They are known for being quite relentless in their lobbying efforts, to the point where many elected officials are afraid. It is obvious the human rights violations, the evictions, the home destructions, the imprisonment, the using children as human shields, the wall. It's very obvious the human rights violations that take place, but yes, people are frightened into silence. What are your thoughts on that, or how we can be supportive and help people speak up who should speak up?
Well, we have to better organize ourselves and organize ourselves strategically, and how to support each other in this movement. And that might take various forms. It may take conversations. It may take conferences. It may take doing research. Any number of things we can do to support each other in this struggle of difficult issues such as these. I think we have to be aware of just how well-organized groups like AIPAC, American Israel Political Action Committee, and even the liberal Zionist outfit called J Street, mm-hmm, they're all Zionists. They affirm Israel's racism and oppression against Palestinians and others. So we just have to be better organized, and we just simply have to develop, I want to say that word deliberately, we have to develop the kind of courage that helps us withstand this and stay in this for the long haul, because it is indeed a long-term struggle.
Yes, it is. And as you point out, it's an anti-imperialist struggle. And that can be difficult for people who feel overwhelmed by the issues they have right here at home in their communities. Very difficult. Issues they're struggling with. What do you say to those people who say of this and other issues that happening internationally, what does this have to do with me? Why should I be concerned about this? What would be your response?
Well, I would appeal to someone's humanity and say, you know, we must be opposed to all forms of injustice. We can organize locally and also be aware of global issues. We do have to do our own research. And as you know, Margaret, being in media, people can often be distracted by a lot of different kind of really frivolous things. But if you're someone who's seeking to be more well-informed, to be honest, to be more politically engaged, we have to organize ourselves in a way that we develop the steadfastness, the discipline to research these issues and try to find out the truth. Of course, that's not an easy task. I think for some of us who've been in the movement a long time, it has gotten easier for us over time. Because as I said at the conference, I've been active in at least one political organization all my adult life, since I was 18 years old to the present. I'm now 65. I've never not been in a movement. I've never not been in an organization. When I was in college, when I was in grad school, there were times I was active in two organizations because I had a lot of interests. But coming back to Palestine, I think one example that I always use to make the connection between local issues and issues in other parts of the world. And again, I want to shout out our comrades from Jewish Voices for Peace and their project called Deadly Exchange, where they research how U.S. police officers are trained in Zionist Israel. In this era of Black Lives Matter and police terrorism against our people, that gets people's attention. So, for example, I gave a presentation a few years ago where, you know, Breonna Taylor, our sister, was killed there in Louisville, Kentucky, right? The former police chief in Louisville, Kentucky, he was a Black man, I think, Robert White. He was police chief in 2011 in Louisville. While he was police chief, some of his officers were in some kind of program where they were trained in Israel. We know police officers of Washington, D.C., New York City, Chicago, other U.S. cities. Now we're seeing a new phenomenon where police officers in small towns in the United States are also being trained in Israel. So for all these brutal cops that we have here in this country, why in the world do you need to go to Israel, what, to learn how to be more brutal? What does that mean? What is that about? What kind of information or tactics are they exchanging? You know, this thing about studying security issues and studying how they handle large crowds. Well, you need to go to all the way to Israel to learn how to handle a large crowd? And who's paying for that? Is that taxpayers' dollars? Is it private foundations? Is it AIPAC? Is it J Street? Is it some wealthy philanthropist? I mean, who's paying for these training opportunities for U.S. police officers? Another example I often use is how the Zionists have a lot of undue influence among some of our civil rights organizations and some of our celebrities. As you were in the workshop where I mentioned about Chris Rock and Will Smith, you know, I said in that workshop, they should slap both of them. Will Smith is very tight with the IDF. There's a picture of him saluting them and smiling and joking with IDF soldiers in Israel. Chris Rock performed in Israel in 2018. The BDS movement wrote him a series of letters, put him on blast on Twitter, and he basically played him off and said, you know, leave me alone, I'm getting paid, right? So these celebrities, and there are others, you know, it's not always about, you know, getting money. Sometimes it's about a certain kind of prestige or a platform or what have you. But these are things that are harmful because they cause confusion, right? Because of the pressure from our movement, the pressure coming from the BDS movement and how it's growing steadily, the various Jewish organizations that are out here that are anti-Zionist and also call for a Palestinian right of return. These are very significant developments in our movement. So I take those things together to say that that shows our progress. We still, of course, have a long way to go, but we can't give up. We have to hang in there. And certainly, if the Palestinian people can hang in there, so can we.
That was Asantewaa Nkrumah Touré joining us from Philadelphia. Landry is a lifelong activist and owner of Nappy Roots Books in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. She is also outreach coordinator for the Lucy Parsons Popular Human Rights Schools for Alliance for Global Justice, which is an effort to develop capacity for transformative change among grassroots activists. She has just returned from Cuba, where she observed May Day activities.
Primarily, going to Cuba means supporting the Cuban people and the Cuban Revolution. And the reason that I support the Cuban people and the Cuban Revolution is that this is what I have basically devoted my life to bringing this kind of justice, this kind of integrity of government, this kind of service to the people is what I have struggled for literally all my life. And Cuba is all of these things in actuality. It's a nation that's working to overcome colonialism, imperialism, racism, and to make a place where people can be their best, where everybody shares in whatever the society has to offer and everybody works together for the common good. This is my goal. This is my aspiration. So anytime I get to go to Cuba, I jump on the chance. May Day was really important. We went down for May Day for a very good reason. And that reason is that May Day is when the Cuban people come together to celebrate the people who work, the workers of the society. And that is so fundamental to the way and the reason that we work for change in this society and this culture. Labor produces all of the value, all of the capital, all of whatever it takes to literally make the world go round. It is the people who build the streets and the buildings and sweep the floors and rock the cradles and tend to the elderly, the people who deliver health care, the people who make goods, the people who get the crops planted in the fields and bring them to market. The people who do the work are the cornerstone of society. And few places celebrate labor and the work of people who are laborers the way Cuba does on May Day. We watched somewhere between 1.5 to 2 million people march down the street, celebrating the contributions that ordinary people make to a society. And it was just simply glorious.
You know, it's interesting. We are told here that socialism doesn't work, and that can be a response to any initiative here that might help people, that might help working people. It's used by the foreign policy establishment to justify the attacks on other countries such as Cuba, the sanctions and so forth. And I've always felt that that was an important reason for people to see these countries, especially those countries that are demonized so badly, so that they can come back and tell people a different narrative, one that we never hear.
That is so critically important, Margaret. The sanctions and the effort to end the embargo are one of the main reasons that we went to Cuba and that we take every opportunity that we can to support the Cuban people. The embargo is literally genocidal. And that embargo is being enacted against better than one third of the human population of this planet, by the way, is embargoed by the United States of America. That is oppression in whatever language you speak. So when you go to Cuba and you look at a nation that is truly suffering from the embargo, I mean, you look at a place where a sheet of plywood costs about $100 or more in U.S. money, and you need a lot of sheets of plywood or bricks or nails or whatever just to keep buildings safe and to create housing for people and other very fundamental things. When you look at a nation that has a struggle to find syringes to deliver into the arms of its people the vaccine that they had to develop on their own because of the embargo, then you realize that this is truly an effort at genocide, an effort to damage and literally murder the Cuban people by the United States in the name of fighting socialism. But let me tell you what socialism looks like. Socialism looks like anybody, whether they sweep streets for a living or are an engineer or some other highly paid, job role in Cuba, is able to walk down the street and walk into a clinic and receive health care free of charge. Socialism looks like Cuba having the second highest rate, life expectancy in this hemisphere, having a maternal mortality rate that is a tiny fraction of what we face here in the United States, where being a Black woman who seeks to give birth can be a death sentence. And that's across the board, no matter whether you're a poor woman living in the projects of Detroit, or whether you're somebody like Beyonce or Serena Williams, multimillionaires well known across the globe who still suffer from medical apartheid, who still have to fight for access to medical care. But in Cuba, that medical care is available to everybody. Cuba has vaccinated 98% of its children and 160-some-odd percent of adults. And now that sounds like bad math, but what it means is that virtually 100% of Cuban adults have had at least one shot, and most have had boosters. Compare and contrast that to the United States, where people of color, poor people in particular, have borne the brunt of the damage that the COVID pandemic has brought to the world, to this nation. That's what socialism looks like in Cuba. Socialism in Cuba looks like anybody in the country who wants to study can study free of charge from pre-kindergarten and nursery school. Childcare is provided. Healthy, safe childcare is provided to every resident free of charge so that their mothers and fathers can work. And this is after a generous maternity leave. And then if you want to study, you can study right up to the postdoctorate level at no charge to yourself. Whatever you dream for yourself, if you're willing to work, you can do it, and it's not going to hit you in the pocketbook. And Cuban people, unlike my children and many, many millions of other Americans, myself included, frankly, will not be faced with like average $70,000 in student loan debt that American young people and middle-aged people are dealing with. That's what socialism looks like. And so the question we need to ask ourselves is, why is the United States against this kind of socialism? What's wrong with taking care of your people instead of meddling with every other nation under the sun?
The goal of this country is to do the opposite, is to make people suffer, is to make life so difficult, to make life so precarious that people are ground down and are less likely to resist, to speak up, and will go along with being exploited. So it's the situation is actually the it's the exact opposite of what we are told. And you have a president like Joe Biden who campaigned. They and the insidious thing is they know what people need and want. So he campaigned talking about student loan debt relief. But after having been president for more than a year, we have yet to see even the modest reform that he was proposing. And having said that, I suppose that explains the antipathy to Cuba.
People hate when they're shown up. You know, when you've got a bully and somebody else comes along and shows how you can do better than the bully, you can do things more beautifully, more justly, more equitably, just better from start to finish than the bully is doing them, the bully gets ticked and the bully continues to bully people. And that explains the embargo, not only against Cuba. In this hemisphere, we have Nicaragua, we have Venezuela dealing with the same thing. Mm-hmm. Cuba, for instance, has really good, you know, high life expectancy, and they provide a lot of preventative health. But one of the disturbing things that is happening in Cuba right now is that deaths from breast cancer among women have risen in the last few years. And it's not because the Cuban medical system isn't providing preventative care. It's because the mammogram machines that are needed to diagnose breast cancer, Cuba can't acquire the parts to keep those machines running. And so Cuban women are suffering because the embargo prevents these vital pieces of equipment from getting into the hands of Cuban doctors so that they can take care of women. And so Cuba's response to this was to develop a vaccine against breast cancer, which so far is working well. But the fact of the matter is, even though Cuban doctors are brilliant and even though everybody in Cuba has access to medical care, why the heck should they have to do this when the machine that would provide this vital care, this life-saving care to women, would be readily available except for the embargo? I'm having a hard time not cussing on this conversation.
Everyone would have that reaction, Camille, if they knew. I think people have a misunderstanding of sanctions. They think it means you can't have a bank account in Havana, when it means that the targeted U.S. businesses, entities, individuals cannot have any sort of economic, financial transactions with the targeted country. And the U.S. will also target any country that defies the sanctions. So U.S. sanctions, in effect, become international sanctions. But I think we also have to talk about the fact that the rest of the world opposes this. And every time there's a United Nations vote about sanctions against Cuba, it's the United States and one or two other countries that vote in favor. And the rest of the world quite literally opposes them.
And the United States does not hesitate to punish other countries. Let's look at the mammogram machines again. A lot of them are made in Germany. And Germany is a major trade partner of the United States. If Germany were to ship mammogram machines or the parts to fix the existing older machines to Cuba, the United States would invoke sanctions on Germany and punish the German people for simply carrying out trade with the Cuban people for life-saving medical care.
And the attacks go on. There's an upcoming summit of the Americas, and the State Department says that Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua will not be invited. So I suppose it's a summit of the Americas, unless you're a left-wing government that we don't like. However, there's pushback, and there are nations who say they will boycott if those nations are not included.
All but one nation of the CARICOM nations, of the Caribbean nations, has pulled out of the OAS summit. And a number of other nations in South America have as well. And incidentally, that is another thing that we did while we were in Cuba last week, is to talk to the Cuban government about taking part in a conference, which Alliance for Global Justice is one of the sponsors of. It is called the Workers' Summit of the America, and it's taking place from the 10th to the 12th of June in Tijuana, Mexico. And the reason it's taking place in Tijuana is that, as you said, Cubans, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, and others are not invited to the OAS summit. And so they are also not able to gain access to the United States, even if they wish to come. And so we're holding it in Tijuana because Mexico is like, why would any nation, any respectable nation, not want to bring people together at a table to work out issues of international trade, of dealing with this pandemic, of making sure that goods and food and services flow, of making sure that everybody in this hemisphere has an equal access to the things that are needed for a decent life. And so Tijuana is hosting this conference for us. I invite people to go to the website workerssummit.com. That's workers, plural, summit.com, and take a look at the information on this conference.
Cuba is a nation that has a large Afro-descended population. Can you talk about what that is like to see Black people living under a system that's so different from ours, living under a system that is dedicated to improving their well-being?
Cuba is indeed an African nation. Fidel Castro proclaimed that many years ago. And in fact, a significant majority of the Cuban people are African people. And so for one thing, when you go to Cuba, you're going home. You know, it's like going to visit your cousins because we're African people. And one of the things that gives me great joy and causes me to support the Cuban people and the Cuban Revolution is that the revolution was in large part carried out by African people and for the sake of African people. Prior to the revolution, African people in Cuba were little more than slaves. They couldn't be bought or sold, but they were condemned to life on plantations and in roles of servants. They were not literate. They were not allowed to go to, there were no schools, there was no healthcare. Now, since the revolution, Black people can ascribe to the highest levels of Cuban society, and Cuba continuously struggles against racism. Racism is a thing. You know, you can't have a situation of chattel slavery for generations and generations and not expect that to become part of the culture. Just because it's part of the culture does not mean it has to be part of the processes, the procedures, the laws, the fabric of the nation state. And that's what Cuba has done and done very, very effectively. So it's one thing for a leader to say, well, I'm not a racist. Some of my best friends are Black people. I was Barack's best buddy, Joe Biden. That's all fine and good, and I'm very happy for you, Joe. But until you change the laws, until you change the policies and procedures that keep African people and other people of color at the bottom of the economic ladder, until we end the policies that end up with black bodies bleeding to death in the streets at the hands of rogue cops, until we change an education system that gives the average Black student about 15 years of education at public school hands, because we start our kids in school at age 2 or 3 in Head Start, but come out with 6 years or 7 years, you know, functioning on a 6th or 7th grade level academically. This is genocide. This is what systemic racism is. Until those changes are made, then you're not serious about ending racism. Cuba is.
That was Camille Landry from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Recently announced that Sundiata Akoli, Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army member, will be granted parole after nearly 50 years of incarceration. The late Glenn Ford, co-founder of Black Agenda Report, spoke at an August 16, 2020 webinar hosted by the Black is Back Coalition. The topic of discussion was the fate of political prisoners like Akoli. Glenn spoke on the need to say political prisoners' names while they're still alive. He also pointed out that all victims of the mass incarceration system are political prisoners, too. We present this excerpt of his remarks.
If you threaten to lead Black people on an independent political path, the U.S. state will attempt to neutralize you, imprison you, or kill you. If you exercise your right to defend yourself and your people from the oppressive arms of the state, they make you into an outlaw and hunt you down. And if you somehow escape from their clutches and find asylum in a comradely country, they will put a bounty on your head, as they have Assata Shakur. When Malcolm's political children formed the Black Panther Party for self-defense in late 1966, they were exercising their right under California law to bear arms in the street. In the beginning, the party was a kind of armed cop watch. The idea was that the cops would be less likely to casually kill people in the Black community if they knew they were being watched by armed Black folks. The party was the white settler state's worst nightmare, Black revolutionary nationalists with guns. Real Black revolutionaries, not figments of J. Edgar Hoover's imagination. They didn't hide their socialism, and they actively fought and sought for fraternal relations with revolutionary movements and socialist governments around the world. The Panthers characterized the police as an army of occupation in the Black community, an army of occupation. Those words were carefully chosen. Malcolm X told us that we should stop talking about civil rights, which are the rights that the government chooses to give you, and instead demand human rights, as spelled out in United Nations documents. Oppressed people should not have to appeal to their oppressor for justice. They have the human right to resist oppression by any means necessary, no matter what the oppressor says. Brother Malcolm had done his homework, his historical homework, and his legal homework. He knew that back in 1949, the Geneva Convention had declared that occupied people have a human right to resist that occupation. The Black Panther Party put that right into practice in response to the Blue Army of occupation in our communities. When Dr. King was murdered in 1968, rebellions erupted in virtually every heavily Black city in the country, and thousands of sisters and brothers were soon knocking on the doors of Panther Party offices across the country, volunteering to join the resistance. When Brother Yesha Taylor talks about revolution being in the air in 1968, that's no exaggeration. The numbers of Panther volunteers were, in fact, far too large for the party to handle. The state set COINTELPRO on war mode. Infiltration was even more pervasive than folks ever imagined. The SWAT team was invented, and the party was soon on the defensive everywhere. The bodies were piling up, and much of the party was facing charges of one kind or another. Many were already in prison. And then, in June of 1969, J. Edgar Hoover made the declaration of war official. He said the Black Panther Party was, without question, the greatest threat to the internal national security of the United States. Hoover vowed to put the party out of existence by the end of the year. The U.S. state was handing down an ultimatum: give up the struggle or become a prisoner or a corpse. Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were among those killed before the year was out. Many of the brothers and sisters who rejected Hoover's ultimatum became political prisoners, and the survivors' pictures are on the Black is Back Coalition poster that we prepared for this conference. The latter part of the Black liberation movement was marked by calls to free Huey, free Bobby, and free Angela. These particular prisoners were freed, but ultimately, the revolutionary Black movement was smashed by the raw, murderous power of the state. However, the U.S. state had an even bigger plan. COINTELPRO and related secret police programs are designed to target and neutralize the leadership of revolutionary movements. But Black people were feeling rebellious all over the country in the late 60s. Federal troops were called in to occupy Detroit in 1967 and to occupy Washington, D.C. and other cities in 1968, when over 100 cities burned. The U.S. state answered this resistance with the mother of all counterinsurgency programs: mass Black incarceration. A mass Black incarceration regime requires the criminalization of a whole people, not just selected and targeted individuals, but a whole people must be criminalized. Black neighborhoods were placed under the most intense surveillance. It was in the last days of Lyndon Johnson's presidency that Congress created the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, which vastly increased federal spending on local police. Essentially, the federal government was massively reinforcing the Blue Occupation Army in Black America. The mission was to create a vastly larger prison infrastructure, the Black Prison Gulag. In just over a generation, the U.S. prison population would swell from only 200,000 in 1970 to well over 2 million, and half of them were Black. One out of every 8 prison inmates in the world is a Black American. And 1 out of every 3 Black male children will go to prison sometime in their lives. That was the U.S. state's answer to the Black liberation movement of the 60s. It was as if the rulers said, you Black folks won't stay in your place, so we've got another place for you, prison. But the advent of the mass Black incarceration regime raises important questions. If the state makes a political decision to criminalize Blackness itself, aren't all Black prisoners of the state political prisoners? That's a question that is wrestled with inside and outside the prison walls. But we do know for certain who went to prison in the service of our movement, in the struggle to free our people, whether they were armed or unarmed. And we embrace our duty and our obligation to these political prisoners, not just during Black August, but in the totality of our political work. The state had help in eradicating the threat of Black revolution. The struggle against Jim Crow apartheid engaged all classes of Black people, but not all Black people wanted a total transformation of society. Some just wanted to get rid of the impediments to their own ability to get rich, or to become a general in the armed forces, or to climb the corporate ladder. They didn't want to overthrow the ruling class. They wanted to join it. For them, the movement was about Black representation at all levels of the capitalist structure, not self-determination for the masses of Black people. It definitely was not about revolution. That would spoil everything for the aspiring Black bourgeoisie, the people that we at Black Agenda Report call the Black misleadership class. They didn't hate the Democratic Party, even though it was the Democrats who created Jim Crow in the South. Instead, they wanted to join the Democratic Party and to rise within the party ranks. And they opposed independent Black politics. They wanted to shut down the mass movement as soon as possible so that it would not continue to disrupt the rich white man's political order, an order that they wanted to become a part of. They had a slogan back then. It said, taking it from the streets to the suites. We saw early on what this Black misleadership class was up to, and it had nothing to do with Black liberation. The first Black big city mayor was Carl Stokes of Cleveland. He was elected in 1967. Among his first acts was to appoint a Black general as the city's police commissioner. And the first thing his general did was to issue dum-dum bullets to the cops so they could kill more Black people. Atlanta's first Black mayor, Maynard Jackson, quickly moved to break the overwhelmingly Black sanitation workers union, the same union that Martin Luther King was supporting in Memphis when he was assassinated. Maynard Jackson said straight up that his main mission was to create a new class of Black millionaires. Long before McFadden and Whitehead composed their hit record, Ain't No Stopping Us Now, the Black liberation movement was brought to a stop by the state with the collaboration of this rising Black political class. We would not even see a glimmer of a mass Black grassroots movement for 2 generations. When we still had a movement that demanded free Huey and free Bobby and free Angela, those particular political prisoners were released. But after the movement was shut down, scores of other political prisoners were left to die in the gulag. Meanwhile, the new class of Black Democratic leaders became the managers of the mass Black incarceration regime. Instead of defending Black people's interests and Black human rights, this class defended the system that criminalized Black people as a group. They were proud to serve the infernal machinery that condemned the best and the brightest of our activists and thinkers to die in American dungeons. For 2 generations, there was no Black grassroots mass movement in the United States. But the Black street never stopped resisting, even without a radical political leadership. The Los Angeles Rebellion of 1992, the Rodney King Rebellion, registered a higher death toll and more property damage than any urban uprising of the 60s. And the generation after Rodney King, our young people rebelled again in the wake of Michael Brown's murder in Ferguson. And this year, they scared the hell out of the state in cities across the country in response to COVID-19 and economic depression. Unprecedented numbers of people were in the streets with young Black folks in the leadership. But in those protests, we didn't hear, and we still don't hear, demands for the release of our political prisoners. They call for abolition of prisons, but that's a long-term goal. But many of our political prisoners have already died, and the rest are old. They can't wait for abolition. The failure of Black Lives Matter demonstrations to demand freedom for all political prisoners is unacceptable and must be criticized. The current movement makes a ritual of saying the names of the recent dead, the victims of police violence. And that is righteous, and it is correct. Say their names. But also, we must say the names of our political prisoners, the political prisoners who are still alive. So we are going to say those names. We're going to go down the list that is published by the Jericho Movement. Abdul Aziz, Virgin Islands 5. Mumia Abu-Jamal, Black Panther Party. Sundiata Okoli, Black Panther Party and Republic of New Africa. Imam Jamil Alameen, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Jalil Muntakim, Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army. Joseph Bowen, a U.S. political prisoner. Baranza Bowers, Black Panther Party. Kojo Bomani Sababu, Black Liberation Army. Fred Mohammed Burton, a U.S. political prisoner. Byron Shane Chubbuck, First Nation political prisoner. Bill Dunn, a class war prisoner. Romaine Chip Fitzgerald, a U.S. political prisoner. David Gilbert, anti-imperialist political prisoner. Jeremy Hammond, anarchist and communer computer hacker political prisoner. Hanif Shabazz Bey, Virgin Islands 5. Alvaro Lunez Hernandez, Chicano political prisoner, and Kamal Siddiqui, Black Panther Party. And that's only a partial listing. Political prisoners are being created all the time because wherever there is political struggle that threatens the state, there will be political prisoners and political casualties. We must say their names while they're still alive to hear us. Say their names while it can still do some good for the living. Say their names because we owe them a debt that can only be repaid by a lifetime of service to the people, as our political prisoners have already done. Free them all. Power to the people.
That was the late Glenn Ford. Thank you for joining this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue every Wednesday.
Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Peace, peace, y'all. I'm Brewex Boogie, representing Bronx-based DJ Collective, Uptown Vinyl Supreme. And every Friday on this station, the Harlem Connection celebrates artists and genres that helped establish Harlem as a cultural mecca. But this week is Bronx Week, and my Uptown Vinyl Supreme crew has been invited to come on board as guest musical conductors. So we hope that you'll join us and tune in this Friday night at 10 p.m. as we ride together and play 100% vinyl of the music that gives us life. Pull up to the station for all that and more right here on the Harlem Connection.
Hello, I'm David Rothenberg, host of a weekly program on WBAI, Saturday mornings from 8 to 10 a.m. I want to call your attention to the upcoming program this Saturday, May 14th, when my guests will include Carolyn Warmus, whose trial 3 decades ago was headlined in the tabloids as the Fatal Attraction Murder Trial. After serving nearly 3 decades in prison, released a couple of years ago, Carolyn will talk about her struggle to clear her name.
You know, David, you know, you and your listeners are getting like an exclusive. This is the first time, I think, publicly with the media, that all of this new evidence that to prove my innocence
being discussed. One of her attorneys joining us is Jeff Deskovic, himself a man who served 15 years in prison in New York State for murder before the Innocence Project cleared him. He will join us with Carolyn as we explore this scramble for justice. Saturday morning, May 14th, 8 to 10 a.m.
And the previous program was Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly. And that is heard Fridays at 5 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for the WBAI evening news coming up. It's almost 6 p.m.